Vaccinations, Parents' Informed Choice by Lynn Bourne. Because the misinformation surrounding vaccination is so extensive, many parents don't even question whether or not they should vaccinate their child, overlooking one of the most important decisions a parent can make. Since medical authorities say vaccination is safe, most parents simply go ahead with vaccination, completely unaware of the potential dangers and unable to recognize a serious reaction when it does occur. And since government health departments and school authorities give the impression that vaccination is 100% mandated for every child in the United States, most parents believe they are legally required to vaccinate their child. These same entities will not tell you that various vaccine exemptions are available for school attendance. In all 50 states, you are free to decline vaccination entirely or adopt a partial vaccination schedule, an important decision about the health and welfare of your child. However, parents face tremendous pressure from doctors, the media, schools, and even other parents to follow the standard vaccination schedule and subject their child to an ever-escalating protocol of multiple injections at various stages of their young lives, even including injections with several vaccines in the same shot. Misinformation. Because vaccines are used predominantly on our precious children, most people assume that the many vaccines have been subjected to thorough trials and rigorous studies proving that vaccines are safe and effective. Parents have been told that mass vaccination campaigns ended multiple epidemics around the world, that vaccines are effective at preventing the illnesses they are intended to prevent, that side effects are rare and generally consist of sore arms or mild fevers that pass quickly, and that the few serious negative reactions are carefully tracked and monitored, keeping adverse reactions to a minimum. However, parents who take the time to dig deeper and pierce this veil of misinformation find that these assertions lack solid scientific backing. Not only has there never been a single long-term study comparing the health and welfare of vaccinated to unvaccinated children, multiple examples can easily be found of vaccinated children acquiring the very illness they have been vaccinated against. Furthermore, there is overwhelming evidence that vaccines can be extremely harmful, permanently disabling, and even deadly to our children. And the current system for tracking and reporting adverse reactions to the FDA is sloppy, poorly executed, and voluntary rather than mandatory, even when a child has been permanently disabled or killed by a vaccine. Vaccination prevents natural immunity. When a baby becomes infected with an illness, his immune system responds through a sophisticated web of interlocking reactions that can produce immunity for life to naturally acquired childhood diseases. These miraculous defenses exist, in part, to keep the illness from taking hold in the deeper systems and organs of the body. But vaccines, which contain both live and dead organisms, genetically engineered DNA, and chemical preservatives, are injected directly into the bloodstream, bypassing the natural immune response. This deprives the body of the ability to develop naturally lifelong immunity in all its complexity to normal childhood diseases like measles, mumps, and chickenpox. Mass vaccination is a man-made attempt to remove the natural infection response from human development and replace it with a series of artificially imposed infections and immune responses determined by the doctor's vaccination schedule. So many shots. In 1983, children received a total of 23 doses of 7 vaccines by age 6. But as of 2019, a fully vaccinated child receives a whopping 70 doses of 16 vaccines by age 18, with 50 doses given by age 6. Most of these vaccines are administered during the early formative years of life, when the child's developing immune system is most vulnerable. Even an adult immune system would be challenged by so many vaccines given during such a short period of time. Evidence of vaccine harm. The medical profession is extremely reluctant to acknowledge adverse reactions to vaccination, even when the reaction is instantaneous or occurs within a few hours, and even with adults who can clearly verbalize their negative reactions, which infants are unable to do. And since no official government studies have ever tracked negative effects that occur over the long term, reactions that occur days, weeks, or years later are almost never attributed to the vaccine. It is a little-known fact that not a single study exists to prove that vaccines are safe over the long term. It would be such an easy study to organize. Use 3 groups of children, the first group fully vaccinated, the second group partially vaccinated, and the third group no vaccinations, then follow them for up to 10 years, and we would be able to see the kinds of problems that are manifesting from these vaccines, says Barbara Lowe Fisher, president of the National Vaccine Information Center. However, evidence of vaccine harm is not really a secret. Thousands of published medical studies have documented both vaccine failure and vaccine harm, even though most pediatricians continue to vaccinate, and most parents remain completely unaware of these studies. One well-known example of a long-term negative vaccine reaction occurred with the polio vaccine used in the late 1950s into the early 1960s. This vaccine was later found to be contaminated with a toxin, said to be monkey virus, SV40, which had tainted the vaccine during production. And even though the problem was discovered in 1960, the contaminated vaccine continued to be given to American children for 3 more years with the full knowledge of government health authorities until it was withdrawn in 1963. 30 years later, SV40 was said to be found to be isolated in bone, brain, and lung cancers of disabled and deceased adults. The SV40 vaccine debacle proves a direct connection between a vaccine and a slow-growing cancer which developed decades after the vaccine. Unfortunately, authorities made no effort to find and track adult recipients of the vaccine, study and catalog their health status, or note their rate of cancer, even though a clear opportunity exists to study long-term effects of a vaccine in a very direct and concise way. Delayed negative reactions have also been confirmed by the work of Dr. Viera Scheibner, who developed a baby monitor in an effort to prevent sudden infant death syndrome. Her monitor sounded an alarm if the baby stops breathing or shows patterns of stress breathing during sleep. In designing the monitor, she had no preconceived intention of specifically tracking vaccination reactions, as it had never occurred to her that vaccinations were in any way problematic or harmful. In the course of tracking infant breathing at night, she recorded the breathing patterns of babies following the DPT injection. She found that the vaccine caused babies much stress, and that this stress showed a remarkable uniformity, with stress flare-ups immediately following the vaccine on day 2 or 5, or delayed reactions on the 15th to 16th or 20 to 25th day in babies who recovered, and those who subsequently died from SIDS. Scheibner's monitor proved that death from the vaccine sometimes occurs weeks after the injection, in correlation with the stress patterns it identified. However, the longer time frame gives doctors and health authorities every excuse not to attribute it to the DPT shot. Adverse events not reported or tracked. One of the great dangers is the fact that negative vaccine reactions are very rarely reported to the adverse event reporting system, a system rife with problems. When a vaccine is released onto the market, post-marketing surveillance is supposed to track any negative reactions from the millions of people taking the newly released vaccine. However, not only is the adverse reporting system entirely voluntary, 90 to 99% of all adverse reactions are never reported. According to David Kessler, head of the FDA for most of the 1990s, and no oversight of any kind ensures that reports made directly to the pharmaceutical companies are then forwarded to the FDA. The process is run entirely by the honor system. A very clear example of poor adverse event documentation occurred during President Bush's smallpox vaccination program of 2003. Before the program, the public was repeatedly told to expect death rates from the vaccine of 1 to 2 per million. In fact, there were 3 deaths, that we know of, among the approximately 36,000 civilians and few hundred embedded reporters who were vaccinated. This makes the actual death rate 80 times higher than what the CDC told the public to expect. Serious adverse reactions, such as brain swelling, heart inflammation, heart attacks, uncontrolled ulceration of the skin, among others, were 1 in 583, 7 times higher than the CDC's original guesstimate of 1 in 4,000. And yet, medical authorities and mainstream news outlets continue to use the old, inaccurate numbers, rather than update the risk estimate as they should. However, it is certain that even these numbers were vastly underreported since, just like childhood vaccination reactions, reporting adverse reactions during the smallpox vaccine was not mandatory and was also limited to an arbitrary and ill-defined time frame of 2 to 4 weeks. What was the rate of death and injury from the vaccine over the next few months and years. All of these important risks should have been studied and tracked for an honest assessment of the true risk of this vaccine. But researchers missed this valuable opportunity due to the usual shoddy and incomplete tracking system that reflects the poor science behind vaccine development. Hepatitis B vaccine at birth. Let's look at the hepatitis B vaccine as a way to examine problems with the development and introduction of any new vaccine. Hepatitis B is primarily an adult disease transmitted through blood and body fluids. High-risk populations include drug users, heterosexuals, and homosexuals with many sexual partners, healthcare workers exposed to blood, and babies born to infected mothers. In 1996, 270 children under the age of 14 were infected with hepatitis B, with only 54 cases reported in the 0-1 age group. In spite of the low risk for children in general, and in spite of the ability to target at-risk children by specifically testing their mothers before birth, the CDC added the hepatitis B vaccine to the recommended vaccination schedule in 1991, with the first of three doses to be administered on the very day of birth before leaving the hospital. In 1986, Merck and Company began marketing the first genetically engineered hepatitis B vaccine. In another example of the poor science behind vaccination development, the FDA approved the vaccine for use after only 1636 doses of Recombivax HB were administered to only 653 children, who were subsequently monitored for only 5 days after each dose. Since the vaccine is recommended for the first day of life, Merck was asked for safety data on newborns. They replied, "We have none. Our studies were done on 5- and 10-year-olds." Further, Merck admitted in 1996 that no data are available for the simultaneous administration of Recombivax HB with other vaccines, even though children are routinely given other vaccines along with Recombivax HB vaccine. Since the introduction of this vaccine, there have been hundreds of reports in the medical literature, mostly published in international medical journals outside of the United States, citing central nervous system diseases, multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, arthritis, severe rashes, fever, chronic fatigue, and sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, as a direct result of the vaccine. Parents have filed tens of thousands of adverse event reports with the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, including emergency room visits, hospitalization, and deaths. A study in New Zealand reported a 60% increase in juvenile diabetes after a massive campaign to vaccinate babies from 1988 to 1991 with the hepatitis B vaccine. Even Merck itself admits to systemic complaints such as fever, joint pain, fatigue, and weakness in up to 17% of all hepatitis B injections. And perhaps most telling of all, over 50% of the doctors surveyed in the UK refused to take the hepatitis B vaccine themselves, citing the known dangers from the vaccine, even though, as medical professionals working in hospitals, they belong to a high-risk group exposed to blood products and needles in the daily course of their work. But most disturbing is the fundamental question of why this vaccine was recommended for infants in the first place. In 1996, there were 1,080 reports of adverse reactions among 0-1-year-olds from the vaccine, including 47 deaths. If only 10% of the true deaths and injuries are being reported, an extremely conservative estimate, this means that there were actually over 10,800 adverse reactions and 470 deaths from the vaccine. Yet in that same year, there were only 54 cases of the disease reported in the 0-1-year-old group. The frightful fact here is that for every child that acquires hepatitis B, the vaccine kills 9 babies and injures 200. Why subject tens of millions of infants to the known dangers of this vaccine when the few babies actually at risk for the disease can be identified by simply screening the mother? And finally, even if parents opt to include this vaccine in their child's vaccine schedule, why is the vaccine given on the day of birth? Parents need time to get to know their child first so they can compare the baby's health status before and after vaccination, so any harm can be noticed, tracked, and treated. In addition to problems with genetically engineered vaccines, many vaccines, notably the MMR chickenpox and Sabin polio vaccines, inject toxic tissue residues said to be viruses into the body. Various stabilizers and preservatives are added, including formaldehyde, lead, aluminum, and MSG. Unknown amounts of RNA and DNA from animal and human cell tissue culture have been found as well. And even though concerned parent groups have fought for the removal of the mercury-based preservative thimerosal from childhood vaccines, the pharmaceutical industry still uses mercury in flu vaccines, which is recommended yearly to all persons starting at age 6 months. Families compensated for loss of their child. Because of the dramatic increase in the number of injuries from childhood vaccines over the past decades, Congress enacted the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, setting up a fund to compensate parents for injured or dead children, as if parents could ever be compensated for the loss of their child due to vaccination. This fund is the first step parents must take when their child has been harmed and serves to shield the pharmaceutical company from all initial liability. As of 2019, the fund has paid out $4.2 billion to parents with approximately 30,000 reports made every year. This is a staggering number considering how many reactions occur that medical authorities refuse to attribute to the vaccine. And if David Kessler is correct, and 90 to 99% of all injuries are not even reported, the true number of children injured or killed by vaccines would be nearly 3 million per year. The many excellent organizations that work to inform doctors and parents of the risks of vaccines describe the anguished phone calls they receive, recounting the devastation, guilt, confusion, and distress that follow. Parents describe babies who, within hours or days of their vaccination, run fevers, become restless or listless, fall into deep sleeps interspersed with piercing screams, arch their back strangely while they cry, fall into comas or repetitive seizures, twitch, jerk, or stare into space blankly, or parents describe a general decline in overall health with constant ear infections, sudden sensitivities to foods and food allergies, sleep disturbances, asthma, unexplained rashes, and loss of developmental milestones, replaced instead with repetitive headbanging or body rocking. Many parents and doctors believe the staggering increase in chronic childhood illness is a reaction to the dozens of vaccines that are now part of the standard vaccination schedule. In the 1960s, autism affected less than 1 in 10,000 families, but now in 2019, 1 in every 36 children are diagnosed with autism. The rate of school children with autism created a huge drain on families, school resources, and social services that can never be remedied if the root cause turns out to be vaccination, as many suspect, and the true solution is never addressed. Childhood asthma, diabetes, attention deficit disorder, and obesity have skyrocketed as well. As the SV40 polio debacle proved what can happen, we may be trading mumps and measles during childhood for cancer and leukemia in adults, says Barbara Lowe Fisher. Do vaccines even work? Even if parents find out about the risks of vaccines on their own, their doctors usually assure them that the risk is worth the almost certain benefit of freedom from infectious disease that their child receives. However, time and again, vaccines have simply not worked against the disease they are targeted to prevent. A 1978 survey of 30 states showed that more than half of all children who contracted measles had been fully vaccinated. Sweden abandoned its whooping cough vaccine after it examined 5,140 cases of whooping cough in 1978 and found that 84% had been vaccinated three times. A 1990 Journal of American Medicine Association article stated that, although more than 95% of school-aged children in the U.S. are vaccinated against measles, large measles outbreaks continue to occur in schools and most cases occur among previously vaccinated children. The medical literature is filled with example after example of the failure of vaccination to furnish protection against common childhood diseases. But rather than accept the premise that the entire system of vaccination is fundamentally flawed, the medical industry calls for booster shots and revaccination without any solid long-term studies to see whether immunity is actually achieved and, if so, for how long. Vaccination did not end epidemics. While we have all been taught that vaccination ended the world's many deadly epidemics, an honest and careful review of original historical medical sources, publications, and statistics from the past 200 years reveals that infectious diseases declined 90% before mass vaccination was ever introduced. Experts attribute the cessation of epidemic diseases not to mass vaccination, but to a major sanitation reform movement that swept Europe during the 1800s. These reforms included moving human waste out of streets via plumbing systems, regularly cleaning streets and stables of horse manure and human waste, improving roads so that meats, vegetables, and raw milk could be distributed in cities while still fresh, and upgrading water distribution systems to prevent bacterial contamination. All the old terror diseases of the plague, Black Death and cholera, responded to these reforms, and epidemics declined throughout the 1800s, long before the advent of vaccination. Even the CDC reported in 1999 that infectious diseases declined in the past century due to improvements in sanitation, water, and hygiene. Vaccination against whooping cough, diphtheria, measles, and polio all occurred only at the very end of the life cycle of each epidemic, exposing the fallacy of the claim that vaccination ended epidemics. The only exception to this decline in epidemic disease is smallpox, which, contrary to all we have been taught, actually increased with the advent of mandatory vaccination and decreased only after an organized uprising by parents and doctors forced European governments to end their mandatory vaccination programs. Even though the World Health Organization claims credit for the eradication of smallpox worldwide through vaccination, the fact is that smallpox declined in countries around the world, whether the population had been vaccinated or not. As Dr. Glenn Dittman said in 1986, it is pathetic and ludicrous to say we vanquished smallpox with vaccines when only 10% of the population were ever vaccinated. Big business creates pressure to vaccinate. The children of the United States represent the most highly vaccinated population in the world. Millions of dollars are provided by the multinational pharmaceuticals to create front organizations like Every Child by Two and Immunization Action Coalition, groups with friendly, neutral names that disguise the pharmaceutical funding behind their mandate to promote vaccination. Vaccines produce billions of dollars a year for the drug companies, in part because the federal government funds massive vaccination drives by buying vaccines with our tax dollars and then giving state health departments millions of dollars with the goal of achieving 100% vaccine compliance. If they fail, the money can be withdrawn from the state. With all this money available to state health authorities, enormous pressure is then applied on the schools, which in turn pressure parents by requiring proof of vaccination for entry into school at every level of a child's development. Resistance. Yet resistance to the mandatory vaccination schedule is growing, and millions of parents are questioning both the underlying science of vaccination and expressing concerns about side effects. A 2003 study found that 93% of pediatricians and 60% of family physicians reported at least one family that had refused a vaccine for their child. For those with a choice, when a parent chooses to limit or opt out of the vaccination schedule, a wide variety of official responses have been reported, ranging from no difficulties at all to the opposite extreme, official threats of medical child neglect charges. It is an unfortunate fact that parents who decline vaccination have been thrown out of their doctor's offices and children have been refused entry into school. In extreme cases, officials have charged parents with medical child neglect and forced them to go to court to retain the right to raise their child. Yet it is also true that many parents experience no resistance from authorities with their right of vaccination refusal unchallenged, as long as they follow the various state laws for exemption. Polio, smallpox, and diphtheria were in decline before the introduction of vaccinations. Mandatory smallpox vaccination in England and Wales resulted in a huge increase in the disease. Typhoid fever died out with no vaccination program. How to opt out? Since this short article cannot examine every vaccine, if you have questions about a specific vaccine, please see the footnotes and recommended reading list at the end of this article to help you decide which, if any, vaccines you feel are safe for your child. While vaccines may be mandated by the CDC and are required for school attendance, no one should have the legal authority to vaccinate your child against your wishes. If the birth will take place in a hospital, you can amend the medical treatment forms or your birth plan and clearly state that you do not want any vaccines for your baby while in the hospital. You should also communicate your request verbally with the staff on all shifts, either yourself or by having your spouse or advocate communicate your wishes clearly and directly. Once your child is born, the pressure to vaccinate comes from two sources: medical authorities and school authorities. Medically, you are free to make any decision at any time you think is best regarding your child's vaccination schedule. However, if you opt out of vaccination, many doctors may lie about vaccines being mandatory or frighten you with exaggerated statistics about the dangers of not vaccinating and refuse to treat your child. Unfortunately, the bread and butter of pediatric practice are the many well baby visits that include vaccination throughout your child's development. However, it is the entry into daycare or school that triggers the need for legal exemptions. There are three types of exemptions: philosophical, medical, and religious. There are medical exemptions in all 50 states, religious exemptions in all but 5 states: California, Maine, Mississippi, New York, and West Virginia as of 2005, and philosophical exemptions in 16 states. You can check the laws for your particular state at nvic.org. Private schools have their own rules and may reject children that have not been vaccinated. Public schools, however, are required by law to accept your exemption when properly prepared according to the laws of your state. Homeschooling currently sidesteps the issue entirely. Once you check the laws for your particular state, you can choose the exemption type that is best for your situation. It is very important to submit the appropriate paperwork to the school so that your refusal to vaccinate cannot be interpreted as parental neglect. A philosophical exemption generally requires a short letter simply stating that you object to vaccination. The religious exemption also requires a letter, but some states stipulate that you actually belong to and are a practicing member of a religion that specifically objects to vaccination. The medical exemption is usually the most difficult to obtain because doctors are subject to review and censure by state medical authorities when they grant exemptions. In some cases, medical exemptions may be obtained from the school nurse and are often easier to obtain than from a physician. Happily, simply signing and submitting the exemption is generally all that is needed. Some exemption letters must be notarized or drafted as a signed affidavit, and some school immunization records have an exemption section on the form itself that you simply fill out. When discussing your decision to opt out, it is best to remain calm, courteous, and diplomatic, even in the face of ignorance or resistance from authorities. Do not enter into arguments with authorities and draw attention to your decision. There is no need to attach documents to your exemption proving evidence of the problems with vaccination or explaining your reasons for opting out. You simply want an exemption for your child. If you encounter belligerent or arrogant authorities who intimidate you with threats of sending you to jail or taking your child away, try to sidestep their resistance in a non-confrontational manner and leave the situation as soon as possible. If you run into this kind of resistance, you should put your wishes in writing, escalate your exemption request to someone above that official, and demand a written response. You'll be surprised how quickly resistance from authorities can fade once they must put their illegal statements and intimidations in writing. Naturally derived immunity. Those of us involved in the Weston A. Price Organization have an intimate understanding of the lies and distortions that various government and corporate forces use to control our food choices. The grassroots campaign for Real Milk started with research into the facts of the situation, analyzed how the media and agribusiness distorted the true history of raw and pasteurized milk, organized a drive for freedom of choice, and supported the farmers committed to producing raw milk. It is these same kinds of distortions and propaganda regarding drugs and vaccines that are sometimes overlooked in the natural food community. The doctor who tells parents that raw milk will give their child TB is the same doctor who assures parents that vaccines are safe, effective, and nothing to worry about. We know that children of the many cultures that Weston Price studied needed no vaccination. They grew up vibrant, healthy, and strong, able to fight off infectious disease as long as they maintained their original native diets. Should a child be in any danger from an infectious disease, we have many powerful tools available to us. Nutrient-dense healing foods, along with homeopathy, acupuncture, herbalism, and naturopathy, all systems of earth-based healing that take into account the full well-being of the whole person to restore and maintain true health. The avalanche of drug scandals exposing death and injury from drugs fully approved by the FDA demonstrates harm far greater than specific problems with individual drugs. Western medicine operates under the assumption that synthetic, genetically engineered drugs and vaccines heal the sick and protect the young from disease, an assumption that parents are expected to accept without question. But when it comes to your children, you are the expert most qualified to decide what is best for them, using your intelligence and common sense in the same way we fight for our right for real food. Recommended books and websites. Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? By Neil Z. Miller, 2002. Check his website for additional books. ThinkTwice.com. National Vaccination Information Center. NVIC.org. For recommended reading, check NVIC.org/resourcecenter.aspx. Immunization, The Reality Behind the Myth, by Woleen James, 1995. Vaccination, 100 years of orthodox research shows that vaccines represent a medical assault on the immune system, by Viera Scheibner, PhD, 1993. How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Doctors, by Robert Mendelson, MD. Sidebars, Mercury and Vaccines and Autism. The Mercury-Autism connection came to the public's attention with the publication of Deadly Immunity by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in the July 2005 issue of Rolling Stone magazine, simultaneous with publication in Salon. Kennedy described a Center for Disease Control and Prevention meeting held June 2000, at which CDC epidemiologist Tom Verstraeten presented evidence to industry and government officials that thimerosal, the mercury-based preservative in vaccines, was responsible for the epidemic of autism in America's children. Instead of taking immediate steps to alert the public and rid the vaccine supply of thimerosal, the attendees spent the rest of the meeting discussing ways to cover up the damaging data. The CDC counters parental anger and negative publicity by citing studies that vindicate thimerosal. Studies opponents claim are doctored and highly suspect. You couldn't even construct a study that shows thimerosal is safe, says Dr. Boyd Haley, one of the world's authorities on mercury toxicity and head of the chemistry department at the University of Kentucky. It's just too darn toxic. If you inject thimerosal into an animal, its brain will sicken. If you apply it to living tissue, the cells die. If you put it in a petri dish, the culture dies. Knowing these things, it would be shocking if one could inject it into an infant without causing damage. Internal documents reveal that Eli Lilly, which first developed thimerosal, knew from the start that its product could cause damage. Yet the lure of profits proved greater than the company's concern for the public. Thimerosal enables the pharmaceutical industry to package vaccines in vials that contain multiple doses. The larger vials cost less to produce as smaller, single-dose vials and are needed to make in mass vaccination programs cost-effective. To read Kennedy's article, see the July 14, 2005 issue of Rolling Stone. But getting thimerosal out of vaccines will not completely solve the problem, as vaccines contain numerous other toxins required for producing and preserving them. If forced to vaccinate, wait until the child is at least 2 years old. Do not give more than one vaccination at a time. Never vaccinate when the child is sick. Be sure that the vaccines are thimerosal-free. Supplement the child with extra cod liver oil, vitamin C, and B12 before each shot. Obtain a medical exemption if the child has had a bad reaction to a vaccination before, or if there is a personal or family history of vaccine reactions, convulsions, or neurological disorders, severe allergies, and/or immune system disorders.